The message you are about to hear is brought to you by Art Bredick. And now, Art Bredick.
Let's turn over to 1 Corinthians 10 today. We're between the holy days, and yet there are something to celebrate even while we're between the holy days. Yesterday, of course, many millions of professing Christians around the world celebrated Good Friday. It's called Great Friday in Hungary. The Norwegians call it Long Friday. And I guess the term comes from, God's Friday. But of course, they have this mixed up, that it's they think Christ was crucified on Friday. And of course, he wasn't. But because of this, they have throngs of people that walk down the Via Della Rosa, and they stop at various places, and they pray. They have services and a mass about 3 o'clock on Good Friday. They clear the altar of all the candles and all the crucifixes and everything, and there they offer prayers. And then they pass a cross. They actually parade it in many congregations around the room when people will kiss it and venerate the cross, and then finally they take communion. But it's all wrong. The symbolism is all wrong. The timing is all wrong. And what the problem with this, of course, is that it really colors and confuses people's view of the truth. Well, God's holy days are different, as we understand. That is, they are prophetic, and they picture axial periods in the history of mankind, and as I say sometimes, his story, God's story. But they picture periods where there are massive changes in direction, so that we realize then that Passover pictured Christ's sacrifice, the people coming out of Egypt, picturing us leaving sin behind. And there was an example there for us in all that was done. 1 Corinthians 10, and of course in verse 6 it says these things were our example, but then again and down in verse 11 it says this: Now all these things happened to them for examples, and they're written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world have come. And so everything, if you think about it, it's just awesome that everything that Israel went through, all of the deaths that occurred, the massive destruction from the plagues, all of those things that occurred to them occurred primarily, I believe, to be an example for us, written to encourage those people who would exist down at the end of the age. And so we see that they kept Passover, and then they celebrated the first day of unleavened bread by leaving Egypt in victory. And through much trial, then, they entered a trek towards the promised land. Exodus 12, if you will. So we also kept Passover. We do this thousands of years later, as it turns out. We realize that it pictured Jesus Christ, his sacrifice for us. Exodus 12. And we rehearse the awesome love of God, the sacrifice that God gave to every one of us. Therefore, we put leaven out of our homes, and we understand that it pictures putting sin out of our lives, and we observe the first day of unleavened bread, and we're reminded that God took Israel out of Egypt, and that we're to come out of this world. We have to be in the world, but not of this world. But what about where we are right now? What do the holy days teach us now? What does the example of ancient Israel tell us? Because there are events between the two holy days that we should pay attention to and that teach us. One was this: the firstborn were sanctified. And another thing was this: a wave sheaf is to be offered during these days. So anyway, the children of Israel kept the Passover, kept it with the rites and ceremonies, and God brought them out of Egypt. And then in verse 43 through 50 of Exodus 12, it says this: And the Lord said unto Moses and Aaron, This is the ordinance of the Passover. There shall no stranger eat thereof. But every man's servant that is bought for money when he's been circumcised, him then shall he eat of it. A foreigner and a hired servant shall not eat thereof. In one house shall it be eaten, and you shall not carry forth aught of any of the flesh, that is, abroad out of the house, neither shall you break a bone of it. All of the congregation of Israel shall keep it. And when a stranger shall sojourn with you and keep the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near and keep it. And he shall be as one that is born in the land, for no uncircumcised person shall eat thereof. And then it continues, one law shall be to him that is homeborn and unto the stranger that sojourns among you. They would keep the same law. Thus did all the children of Israel, as the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron, so did they. And it came to pass that selfsame day that the Lord did bring the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt by their armies. And so after this, God tells Moses something else of great significance. Let's read that in the next verse, chapter 13, verse 1. And the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, sanctify unto me all of the firstborn, whatsoever opens the womb among the children of Israel, both of man and of beast, it is mine. And so it is believed that then God, the first time they stopped, probably at Succoth, and he ordered that this ceremony take place. The firstborn of Israel were exempt from the destroying angel and all those things that happened in Egypt. And each one of them then became set apart here as God's personal property. And of course, he was speaking primarily of the firstborn males. But the firstborn were to be sanctified. That meant they were set aside. They were to be different. They were to be devoted to God, uniquely holy, and set apart for that purpose. And so the men, every firstborn man, became the servant of God. And they were to serve God in a special way and live a holy life personally. But they were also then to help, even serving in the tabernacle at a later time. And so God commanded the Israelites to sanctify their firstborn. They were to be his. All of the animals, they were to be sacrificed. Let's pick this up again. Exodus 13 and verse 12 this time. Exodus 13, verse 12. And here it says, you shall set apart unto the Lord all that open the matrix, and every firstling that comes of a beast which you have, the males shall be the Lord's. And every firstling of an ass you shall redeem with a lamb. And if you'll not redeem it, then you shall break its neck. And all the firstborn of man among the children shall you redeem. And it shall be when your son asks you in time to come, saying, what is this that you shall say unto him, by strength of hand the Eternal brought us out from Egypt, from the house of bondage? And it came to pass, when Pharaoh would hardly let us go, that the Lord slew all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. Therefore I sacrifice to the Lord all that opened the matrix, being males, but all the firstborn of my children I redeem. And so it was that the children then, the males, could be redeemed for 5 shekels, and that money then went to help support the Levites later on and the temple and service there. And the unclean animals that were able to be used to farm and so on, and for transportation, those could be redeemed by a clean animal as well. If you didn't redeem it, that animal was to be killed. There was not to be any using of these animals for a different purpose than what God had said. And I'm saying this because I believe it was so important, the sanctification of the firstborn. And so the Israelites were to dedicate their firstborn, and it was done. And as a reminder, too, of the death of Egypt's firstborn, but I believe it also looked forward to and pictured Jesus Christ. There's a symbolism here that I think should be understood by every single one of us as believers, and I think we're inextricably, if you'll let me say it, connected to this setting apart of the firstborn. Now notice the next verse, what it says here. Verse 16, it shall be for a token upon your hand and for frontlets between your eyes, for by strength of hand the Lord brought us forth out of Egypt. And this is hearkening back to a scripture just prior to this in verse 9. Let's read that. It's a little more clear. For it shall be for a sign, in verse 9 it says, unto you upon your hand and for a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand has the Lord brought you out of Egypt. And so we see then this mark of God, as it were, the same word sign when he uses to speak of God's Sabbath, oweth, that it was a sign, a mark, a token, a flag, a beacon. It was pointing to and identifying God's people to be worn in the forehead. God has a mark that's worn in the forehead, and it's worn in the hand. And these things are symbolic. That is, that the mind, right here in the forehead, this is where conscious reason thought takes place, you see. And so the hand refers to what we do with our strength. And so God's telling us by this that it's something that we are to think about. And it's something that is to produce actions in our lives. And that's what much of all of this was all about. Let's go to Romans 8 for a moment. Romans 8, if you will. After leaving Egypt, God required Israel to sacrifice the firstborn. And I want to remind us today that it is Jesus who is the firstborn. And God the Father had to witness then the death of his firstborn son. And so it says in Romans 8, and it says in verse 29, for whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his son, that he, Jesus Christ, might be the firstborn among many brethren. Now what's interesting here is that Jesus Christ is said to be the firstborn, but he's the firstborn among many others, you see. So he was the cost that the Father had to pay for all of us. He was the cost that it was to redeem us back from death. And for this reason, then, we see that the death angel then did not pass over the firstborn in Egypt, but did pass over the firstborn of Israel. But there's a connection to this and us. Look at the next verse in verse 30. Verse 30. Because it talks about us now. Moreover, whom he did predestinate, them he also called. And whom he called, he also justified. And whom he justified, he also glorified. Let's back up a little bit to Romans 6, if you will. See, I say this. It was in God's plan for us to be called. And once called, we would be chosen, we would be justified. And then ultimately, we're going to be glorified. And God, of course, says this, that he calls those things which are not as though they are. And the reason he can do that is because he's Almighty God. And when he says you will be glorified, there is absolutely nothing that can stop that. No outside force. We, could, of course, could abandon the process. We could exempt ourselves. But there's no external force in the world, in the universe, if you will, that can prevent this. And so he says it with great force and power there. But what I'm saying today is this, that we are unified with Jesus Christ. We become one with him. And so we share, ultimately, to share in his throne, right? Ultimately, to share as brethren, it speaks in another place. We share in him. And so the scriptures talk about this here in Romans 6, verse 3 through 5, where it says this, know you not that so many of us as were baptized into Jesus Christ were baptized into his death? Therefore, we're buried with him in baptism unto death. And like as Christ was raised up from the dead by the glory of the Father, even so we also should walk in newness of life. And then it says in verse 5, for if we've been planted together in the likeness of his death, we shall be also in the likeness of his resurrection. And so we were then, you see, put to death with Christ. And we will, if you'll go to Hebrews 12, we will be raised in the likeness of his resurrection. That is, 1 John says, we'll be like him. So back to Hebrews 12. I want to pick up a scripture here and talk about it for a moment. By virtue of our union with him then, we too become firstborn. Hebrews 12 and verse 22 says this, but you are come, speaking of God's people, unto Mount Zion, and unto the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn, which are written in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of just men made perfect. And so it is then, the first resurrection are called the church of the firstborn. And there's two ways this scripture can be looked at. And one way is that Jesus Christ is the firstborn, and that we then become a part of the church that belongs to him. And that's a legitimate understanding. But the second understanding is this. Through union with him, we become the church of the firstborn. We are also firstborn. And we'll see this later, that he's the first fruits. But guess what we're called later on? The first fruits. And so because of our union with him, you see, we become the firstborn. And there's a point I make in all of this. I believe that we are the church that is the church of the firstborn, meaning we are the firstborn as well because of our union with him. And we're the ones that the firstborn Israelites pictured in this ceremony, in this sanctification and setting apart. You remember the scriptures, they are not all Israel that are of Israel. Because why? Because it wasn't according to the flesh. The ancient Israel only pictured a spiritual Israel that would exist later on. And so you see this over again, over and over again, where it talks about those who would walk according to this rule, that is, according to God's way. They are, Galatians says, the Israel of God. And so we are the Israel of God, not those ancient Israelites. And that's why what they did and what they went through, it was all written for us at the end of the age, who would be called spiritually to be what ancient Israel was supposed to be and was not able to be. And remember that everyone in Israel, many as they were, 2 million of them, were not all firstborn. Only the firstborn were selected out of Israel, and they were sanctified and set apart and dedicated and devoted to God. Likewise, there are many today that are called, but only a few are chosen. And it's those chosen, you see, that become the church of the firstborn as I see it. And it is those then that are to be sanctified by this calling out of Egypt, by us being freed from the bondage of sin. Those individuals that are the firstborn are sanctified, set apart to be devoted to God, to live holy lives, and to one day serve in His temple. Do you see the analogy I make here? That it's a unique and special calling, a beautiful thing, and it's something that happened after the first day of unleavened bread. And so I want us to celebrate this, and I want to ask us too, as we celebrate the days of unleavened bread, always remember who we are. Remember our identity, that we are the church of the firstborn, and as that, are to live holy lives to the very best of our ability as we're led by God. Let's go to Leviticus 23, because we're also in a unique spot during these days regarding the timing of the holy days this year. This year, the holy days fall the way they did during Christ's time, that is, where Wednesday was the Passover. And then he was resurrected, of course, at the end of the Sabbath time, the Saturday Sabbath. But Jesus wasn't crucified Friday, as so many people believe, that it was actually, when it talks about the Sabbath drawing near, it was the preparation for the days of unleavened bread, the first day of unleavened bread. And so they would keep that holy day and rest as commanded. And then Friday they went out and prepared spices, bought those things that were necessary. Then they rested that Saturday, and then after that, the next day, they came to the tomb. But it was during the Saturday, you see, that we're celebrating right now. I want you to think for a moment. Jesus Christ was dead on that corresponding Saturday. And that he would be raised probably about the time after our Q&A, when we're sort of wrapping up services and beginning to head out, that would have been the time that he would have been resurrected. But the point I want to make today is between the days of unleavened bread, there is something that takes place. And it takes place correspondingly, if we were to look at it the way they line up this year, it would be taking place Sunday. And this is why I think it's such a tragedy, the Easter Friday crucifixion, Easter Sunday resurrection, because their keeping of Easter completely obfuscates the truth about the wave sheaf that was to be offered on Sunday. And so there is this unique ritual and ceremony that transpired during the time between the two holy days that has profound significance, great meaning for every one of us, that I want us to consider and think about today. Leviticus 23 and verse 9 through 11 says this: And the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, When you be come into the land which I give to you, and you shall reap the harvest thereof, and then you shall bring a sheaf of the firstfruits of your harvest to the priest, and he shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted for you. On the morrow, after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. And so here it is, speaking about the Sabbath, that is the weekly Sabbath, that falls between the days of unleavened bread. And after that Sabbath, that is tomorrow, they were to take a sheaf of the first harvest, and they were to take this, and they were to hold it up, lift it up, and wave it to be accepted by God the Father. And so at the time, then, this was to occur, would be this Sunday, and they were to take a sheaf. And it was to be the very first taken from all the harvests, and it was called the first fruits. And no crops in all of Israel could be touched. Nothing could be harvested until this ceremony had taken place. In verse 14 it says this, "And you shall eat neither bread, nor parched corn, nor green ears, until the selfsame day that you have brought an offering unto your God." And he says, "It shall be a statute forever throughout all your generations and in all your dwellings." And so the priest then would wave this offering, this sheaf, the morrow after the Sabbath. Now, on Sunday, it would be lifted up and waved towards heaven. And it actually pictured something literally being transferred to heaven. This wave sheaf was presented to and accepted by the Almighty God, no less than the Father, in heaven. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 15. 1 Corinthians 15. These physical harvests, of course, pictured the spiritual harvests. There were two physical harvests that took place primarily in Israel. A spring harvest that was mostly barley and some wheat, but then it was a small harvest. And there would be then a later fall harvest that would be a greater, notably greater harvest. But God said this, the first harvest could not even begin to take place until this wave sheaf, this first fruits of the harvest, had been cut and lifted up and waved. And only then could any other harvest take place. And the reason for this is this, because the sheaf represented Jesus Christ, who he had to first be harvested before any of the rest of God's spiritual harvest could ever be taken, because Jesus is the first fruits. And so it says in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 20, 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 20, "But now is Christ risen from the dead, and he's become the firstfruits of them that slept." Verse 23, "But every man in his own order," it says, "Christ the firstfruits, and afterwards those that are Christ at his coming." And so there was a ritual that took place. It wasn't detailed in the Bible, but it was something that was carried down orally. And it did say that to the Jews was that they kept the oracles of God, and they kept many traditions that I believe they didn't simply read in the Bible, but there were things that were handed down orally. The calendar, for one, was done this way. And so I believe there's so much deep symbolism in the way this wave sheaf was offered. It was carried out in exact detail. The officials of the temple would first choose the best of the grain, and they would bind it into a stack, and they would tie it up before it was even cut so that it would be easier to cut when they did. And they'd stand, all of them, the officers, and then they would have a number of witnesses with them. And the priest would have a sickle in his hand, and the others would surround the priest. And the reason they surrounded him was to make sure that everything he did was going to be followed exactly according to the precise detail, and it would be done correctly. And then the priest would ask this question, "Is the sun set?" That is the Sabbath over with? And those surrounding him would answer, "Yes." And he would say this three times, and then he would ask, "Shall I reap?" And those surrounding him would say, "Yes, reap." And then he would cut the bound grain. And yet, it was not yet offered. There was something else that would take place. The grain would be parched, and it would be parched with fire. First, they beat this grain with reeds. And they beat it this way in a soft way so that they wouldn't crush the grain. And I think this corresponds to the fact that Christ, of course, was scourged, but a bone wasn't broken. He wasn't crushed in that sense. And then the grain was parched, and it went through a fire. And, of course, fire is a symbol of trial in the Bible. And during this time, you see Christ whole life as a trial, and you begin to look at this ceremony, and I think you can see how it ultimately ended in this tragic trial of this beating and death that was his. Then this offering was put through the grist mill, and it was sifted through 13 sieves, and they now added an ephah of flour and oil and frankincense. And I think this pictured, in one sense too, the grinding trial that he went through, added with the Holy Spirit pictured by the oil and the prayers that the frankincense pictures elsewhere in the Bible, his prayers, his offering of himself and all that he was with the Holy Spirit as a sweet-smelling savor. But you understand my point, this wave sheaf offering did picture Jesus Christ. It was chosen in advance, as Jesus Christ was. It was bound, as he was also bound, tied in a bundle it was. And then the first fruits were cut off, which I believe pictures Christ's death. And it was loosed from the ground at the very same time, that is the end of the Sabbath, the same time that I believe Christ was loosed from his grave. And also, it was also loosed in this sense, that Christ, when raised, was no longer bound to needing sustenance, to air and water and food and all of that. In like manner, you see, the grain, once cut off, was no longer needing to have roots in the ground and so on. Its purpose now had changed, and it would be used for something else. And finally, it was raised, and finally it was offered before the altar to God in heaven. And then the offering was lowered again. And I think it pictured Jesus Christ being raised and being accepted by the Father and then coming back to this earth once again. So remember this, John 20. John 20, if you'll go over there. The next day after the Sabbath, the women came to the grave. It was still dark when they arrived, but Jesus was already raised, and it was way before the sunrise. John 20 and verse 1 says this: "The first day of the week came Mary Magdalene early when it was yet dark under the sepulchre, and she saw the stone taken away from the sepulchre. And so then the other apostles were brought over to the tomb, and they saw that it was empty, and they returned to their homes, but Mary stayed there." I remember when Mr. Armstrong died, I had the same sort of similar experience in one sense, because I remember that everybody eventually left, and I couldn't bring myself to leave. What was happening to me was so profound and so meaningful, so finally I was forced to leave, but I just couldn't bring myself to actually leave that spot for a long, long time. So I think I can kind of understand where she was coming from. So she didn't leave, but then she looked in again and saw these angels, and the angels told her that he had risen, and then she turned, and here she sees Jesus Christ. She doesn't know it's him at first, and perhaps it was like in the case of the letter we received, where she had trouble seeing through the watery eyes. You never can tell. Maybe that's why she didn't recognize him. Maybe it was because he still had some of the signs of the beating and so on. But anyway, Jesus Christ then speaks to her. And in verse 16, Jesus said unto her, "Mary." And she turned herself, and she said unto him, "Rabbi," which is to say, "Master." And then Jesus said, "Touch me not, for I am not yet ascended to my Father." And then he said, But go to my brethren, and say unto them, "I ascend unto my Father, and your Father, and to my God, and to your God." And that's a profound and powerful statement there, and there's so much in it. But Jesus Christ tells her first, "Don't touch me." He doesn't want her to touch him. And I think there's a reason for this, and that's because he had not yet ascended to the Father. That evening, he shows himself to his disciples, and he says, "Touch me." Remember, 8 days later, Thomas, he says, "Oh, stick your hand right here in my wound." So there was something that he didn't want them to touch him before. But in the later evening, he was allowing them to touch him. What's the difference? I think that it was that he didn't want human touch, because human touch may have conceivably defiled him some way ceremonially. That there was a case, of course, when God gave the law and he said, don't make an altar. When you make an altar, don't use a human tool on it. Because even a human being using a tool on an altar somehow corrupts it. And so it's possible that this is what it was. But some teach out there that Jesus Christ didn't ascend now and that this word means to cling or hold on. But I looked up that he didn't want her to hold on to him in his physical form, is what they say in the commentaries. When I looked up all the places that same word is used in the Bible, it just means to touch. Remember, someone touched the hem of his garment. Somebody touched him, and he says that, you know, don't let the evil touch individual Christians and so on. It was just touching him. I'm convinced of this. And they were not understanding the importance of the wave sheaf offering. I think they construct these arguments trying to understand why this happened. Why wasn't he wanting her to touch him? So I'm suggesting that he, as the wave sheaf, was going to ascend to heaven and didn't want anyone to touch him until that had occurred. And so he was going to be passed before the Father and accepted as the first fruits of God's harvest. Now let me speculate for a minute, because I don't think that Christ's return to heaven there was a rush job. I really don't think that. You remember how it says in 2 Peter that a day is like 1,000 years to God, and 1,000 years is like a day. And I think there's two meanings to this. There's a double-sided coin, in a sense. That is, God can patiently wait 1,000 years to take what would normally only take a day to take and do. And so the inference is patiently wait, because 1,000 years to God is like a day. He's got plenty of time. But on the other hand, I actually believe you can flip that coin around, and that I believe that God can take 1,000 years of work, and he can condense that and he can accomplish it in one day. And so the reason I say this is because I believe Jesus Christ, perhaps let's say he rose at 10 o'clock or something in the afternoon or in the morning, and perhaps he came back to earth maybe at 4 o'clock that later afternoon. You understand that weeks, months, even years worth of activity could have taken place in that time, because I believe that God can live inside and outside of time. That he says that he inhabits eternity. And so time for him isn't the same way that it is for us. And so I want us to think a little bit, if you'll let me speculate, of some of the activities that he would have experienced when he went back to heaven. Have you ever returned to your home of origin after being gone a long time? Sometimes it's a very beautiful thing to go back and to drink in all of the fond memories and so on. In today's world, in the city, things change so fast. I mean, if I went back to where my city of birth, I don't think there'd be hardly anything standing. There'd probably be all kinds of office buildings and all of that. But in the past, you understand, when people lived in more rural economies, when they could go back, they would see the stream that they played in as a child. They would see the beautiful rolling hills. They would see the fields and the farmlands and things like that. And it would be a rich, moving experience to come back to something like that. Remember some of the vets returning after the war to go back to their homes. What would that be like for them, going back to their source of origin and their home? You can understand the beautiful feelings, I think, that Jesus would have experienced at that time. He was returning to a world of enormous beauty. It was filled with resplendent majesty and glory, beautiful to behold. Think of it, splendiferous, the throne of God, the magnificent jeweled city there of New Jerusalem, just radiating out, as it says, the jewels on the throne, the jewels even on the foundation. A gorgeous place, not like the dusty streets and dirty places in the city of Jerusalem. What would it be like for him to return to that? What a joy it would have been, the magnificent angels adding their honor and dignity to the whole scene. Amazing. Let's go to John 16, too. All the dignity, the glory that was present with him before, all the familiar, wonderful sights and sounds and smells and things that were there in heaven, he went back and could appreciate that probably as never before. You can hear it. John 16. I also think of the reunion. It is Jesus Christ's sole concern when he was on earth. The thing that he prized more than anything else was the relationship that he had with the Father. And before he died, he was there on the cross and he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? And God, it says, can't look on evil. And so we believe then that Christ had to actually see the Father turn his back on him, that he would lose, be cut off from God, to have all of the sins of mankind and the filth and degrading things, the shame that you and I feel, placed on him. And he felt that and then lost at the same time his relationship with God. And you can imagine how horrifying this would be. But after the resurrection and being raised to go back to heaven, you understand he would be free of all of that. That would be gone. John 16 and verse 21 says this, "A woman, when she's in travail, has sorrow because her hour is come. But as soon as she's delivered of the child, she remembers no more the anguish for joy that a man is born into the world." Well, Jesus Christ went through that horrific trial that he went through. But afterward, you see, in the resurrection, it would be so a part of the past. It would be so forgotten for the joy that was now before him. And there would be the restoration, the welcoming back of all the angelic host, of the Father, and the embracing that would have gone on. And I know that God is not a man, but I want us to think for a minute. We don't have the feelings and the emotions or the commitment or the loyalty or any of that or the love that God the Father and Jesus Christ have. But you understand, Christ coming back to the Father, if it were just humans, wouldn't there be embracing? Wouldn't there be trembling and tears and hugging? Wouldn't there be the joy of looking into your Father's admiring look, the pride that he would have for you, for what you had accomplished? Man, I think so. I really think there would have to be something like that with Jesus Christ. The oneness, again, the sense of redounding love together, the absolute thrill of eternal fellowship restored, and the reacquainting and the congratulations of all the angelic host. You know, when a war hero comes back, they often will have parades for him. They'll throw out a welcoming mat, the likes of which you don't generally see. And you've seen the ticker tape parades and everything that go on. Well, don't you think there would have been some of that with Jesus Christ returning as the angels were so thrilled? And how many, millions or billions all assembled there? I think it would have been far greater than most of us can even imagine. Let's go to Daniel 7 for a moment. Daniel 7, there's a unique prophecy here, a vision that Daniel had and something that he saw. Because there would also be something else that would take place upon Jesus Christ's return to heaven to be accepted of the Father. Once accepted, of course, he would be coronated as King of Kings. And this is described here, I believe, in Daniel. There would be it seems to me at least, that the Father is like this, that he likes ceremony. You know, when you look at the priestly line and you see the ceremony and you see the rituals, he's so specific about how he wants things. He wants the finest quality of robes and the beautiful stones that would be in the breastplate, and it was all by design and it all had symbol and so on. And when the holy days came, they were to be orchestrated a certain way. So you understand what I'm saying? If Christ were to come back and he was to be coronated as King of Kings, it wouldn't just be happening in a sort of backyard marriage kind of thing. I think it would be a huge orchestrated ceremony from the very mind of God the Father. I think it would be awesome. But Daniel 7 speaks of it here, Daniel 7 and verse 13, where it says, "I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples and nations and languages should serve him. And his dominion, it's an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away. And his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed." And so Christ would have been brought before the Father here. He would have been lifted up, raised to heaven, and there accepted of him. And there he would have been crowned in a beautiful ceremony as King of Kings, and he would be there set to be our high priest and to fulfill that office as well. In my mind, you know, I don't know how you envision it, but after the ceremony, I just can imagine a billion or more angels in incredible applause for what had taken place, just deeply appreciative and able to be a part of it all. magnificent singing accompanied by orchestras, you know, harps as it says in other places, and a great musical fanfare with it. Success, triumph, restoration, acceptance, all of this taking place when Jesus Christ returned. Hebrews 2. Jesus Christ was raised with glory and with honor there. The author of Hebrew discusses mankind in this context, actually talks about us and says, what is man? Why do you care about man? Or why do you visit him and so on? And then realizes, well, you've put everything under man's control, but you haven't put everything there. And then, but we don't see everything. We see partly. We don't see everything that's under our control, whether we look out with the Hubble telescope and we see the massive galaxies that seem to go unending. You can turn that right around with an atomic microscope, and you can look at universes in the atomic world and particles and things that are going on there too. We don't see everything we're going to control. We don't see the magnificent and glorious spirit beings that it says one day we'll judge, and I take that to mean manage. So we don't see all of that, but it says we do see something. What do we see? Well, we see Jesus Christ, and we see him being crowned. Hebrews 2, verse 9 and 10. Hebrews 2, verse 9 and 10. Where it says, but we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels, just like we were, for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he by the grace of God should taste death for every man. Then it says, it became him for whom are all things and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings. It's a beautiful comment there. The word captain is an interesting word. In the Greek, it is archigos. And it actually means more like pioneer. It means someone who goes before the others. That is someone who would blaze a trail. You understand, I remember down in, when I went to Guyana, and you go into these forests that have existed for probably hundreds of years, and I'm telling you, there's no way you can get through that forest. You could go about 5 feet, you'd be absolutely exhausted with your machete. But you understand, somebody goes before you, and they cut some of this down, and then if you come along later, it's not so difficult. And you know that if somebody went before you, you know you can go also. But the point that he's making here is we see Jesus Christ crowned as King of Kings and crowned as our High Priest. We see him raised to heaven and there accepted by the Father. And then we see that he returned back to the earth afterwards. And I'm saying today, we can follow that. We will follow in his footsteps. We will follow the same pattern, is what I'm getting at. Let's go back to Leviticus 23 and look at the wave sheaf just a little bit more. I believe this is what the wave sheaf was picturing as it was raised and accepted, the first fruits it was called. Verse 15. In verse 15 it says, and you shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be complete. Even unto the morrow after the 7th Sabbath shall you number 50 days. And then you shall offer a meat offering unto the Lord. And so that Sunday, when Christ was raised and accepted, the wave sheaf count began. And the count was to be counted for 49 days, 7 Sabbaths, and then on the 50th day, Pentecost was kept. And we remember in Acts 2 that that was a day in which God fulfilled sending his Holy Spirit. But on this day, 2 loaves of bread were offered to God, Leviticus 23, again in verse 17. And you shall bring out of your habitation 2 wave loaves of 2/10 deals, and they shall be of fine flour, and they shall be baked with leaven. They are the first fruits unto the Lord. And you shall offer with the bread 7 lambs without blemish of the first year, and 1 young bullock, and 2 rams, excuse me. And they shall be for a burnt offering unto the Lord with their meat offerings and their drink offerings, even an offering made by fire of sweet savor unto the Lord. And then you shall sacrifice one kid of the goats for a sin offering and two lambs of the first year for a sacrifice of a peace offering. And then it says the priest shall wave them with the bread of the first fruits for a wave offering before the Lord with the two lambs, and they shall be holy to the Lord for the priest. And so think about this now. On the 50th day, you see, there were two loaves, and these loaves were made with leaven. There's virtually no other offerings in the Bible that are given to God with leaven in them. Leaven is a type of sin. Well, what could this mean? Well, I think it means this. Who are the two loaves? The two loaves, I would suggest to you, are the Old Testament church and the New Testament church. The two churches and the two testaments and the two time periods. And the loaves are what? The first fruits. These are harvested from the first harvest. And they have leaven in them because you and I will never be perfect like Christ. That we will be waved and accepted to God. But why? Because of our inherent goodness? Because we didn't make any mistakes or we didn't let God down? No. Because of Jesus Christ and because of His blood and because of His sacrifice. That's what justifies us, and that's what makes us clean, and that's what makes us pure before God. And so these two loaves were done with them. They were raised. They were lifted up, and they were waved before God for acceptance and then brought back down. And so I believe this then pictures us as the resurrected church of God, ascending to God, and there being with Christ, married to Him, becoming one with Him, like a wife becomes with a man. He's the first fruits. We, therefore, are the first fruits. We're united with Him. We are the firstborn because He's the firstborn. And we are one together. And it's a wonderful truth, I believe. And each day that we picture in God's holy days pictures a part of His plan. But this is something that occurs between the two holy days that I think should give us great hope. Let's go to Revelation 14. Revelation 14, and I'll conclude over here. Israel sanctified. They set apart. They devoted their firstborn. And then there is a wave sheaf offered between these 2 days of unleavened bread. And I think there's an enormous meaning for us. Through union with Jesus Christ, we become firstborn. We become the first fruits, the first harvest. In Revelation 14, here we see a picture, a vision that John has given, in which an angel explains who these people are, but we see them resurrected. We see them standing on a sea of glass. We see them there at the base of Mount Zion, which I believe, from the scriptures we read in Hebrews, is clear it is the New Jerusalem, the heavenly Jerusalem, it says, that we're brought to that mount. And here's where they are, and they're singing, and they're rejoicing. And the angel tells John who they are. John is told this in verse 4. These are they which were not defiled with women, it says, for they are virgins. That is, not with false churches. And they've kept themselves pure. These are they which follow the Lamb wherever He goes. They were redeemed from among men, being the firstfruits unto God, and unto the Lamb. Jesus Christ was the captain, the pioneer. He was the archigos. And He blazed a trail that we're able to follow. It's a wonderful truth that He was raised and accepted by the Father and came back down to earth. And we too will one day be raised and be there with the Father and sing and rejoice in a wonderful and beautiful ceremony, much like that, I believe, of Christ. And then we will return with Him back down to this earth. So the events between the holy days teach us a wonderful truth, I believe. We can follow Christ and be with Him. And so I remind us today, follow Christ as He leads us out of sin. Follow Christ as He leads us to His kingdom.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you found the message beneficial. If you would like to know more about the Eternal Church of God, we would like to hear from you. You may contact us at 1-800-723-6108. We also invite you to visit our website at eternalcog.org. Once again, thanks for listening.